This is Ozarks at Large. Monica Ramirez, Deputy Director of Centro de los Derechos del Migrante, has quite the resume. After graduating law school, she founded the first U.S.-based project dedicated to representing female farm worker victims of gender discrimination, including workplace sexual violence. She worked at the Southern Poverty Law Center for 6 years and co-authored the report, Injustice on Our Plates, Immigrant Women in the U.S. Food Industry. Last week, she was in Northwest Arkansas to be the keynote speaker at the 3rd annual Cesar Chavez Commemoration Dinner, which is organized by the Northwest Arkansas Workers' Justice Center. While she was in town, Ramirez stopped by Studio 123 to discuss her work with me. To begin our conversation, I asked her how she found herself as an activist, attorney, author, and speaker who is so involved in the issue of ending sexual harassment against farm worker and low-wage immigrant women.
I started working on issues related to farm workers and particularly sexual harassment from a very early age. I come from a farm worker family, and so growing up I was very aware of some of the exploitation against farm workers. And then also the issue of sexual violence is a very personal one to me because it's an issue that's affected my family. And so growing up, those two issues, you know, the experiences of farm workers and the reality of sexual violence were just things that were very close to my heart. And so when I made the decision to go to law school, I went with the idea that I would become a farm worker attorney, and then I had the opportunity to create my dream job, which was to represent farm worker women who are victims of workplace sexual violence, because it's a huge problem, and I knew that there wasn't anyone else in the country that was focusing their work on that. And so I think that when you start a project like mine from the ground up and there's no one else focusing 100% of their time on it, two things happen. You quickly become an expert, even though at, you know, 25 and as a new attorney, I don't know that I should have been the expert on the issue. I was still figuring it out. But you quickly become an expert because there's no one else focusing their energy on that. And then I think that that easily lent itself to the speaking and the writing and the advocacy, because all of those roles need to be filled. And using those different mediums, I needed to bring on allies to fight for the rights of migrant women. And so I think it happened organically and really because of the needs that existed. And so I've been really fortunate. My career has taken both an exciting path because it's gone in so many directions and it became both national and now international in terms of the scope of the work. But at the same time, it's been really challenging because the problem is so big. And when you're doing the lawsuits and writing and speaking and teaching and technical assistance, at times it can be overwhelming, but it's been I've been really fortunate to be able to do what I do.
And where did your family move here from?
My family's from Mexico.
And when you got started, you know, you said there, nobody was really doing this, so you were sort of the first. How do you decide to be the first? Because I feel like that takes a lot of, I don't know, initiative and bravery in one sense, because there's not someone out there that you can just follow. You're just kind of out there on your own.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, just to be clear, there were other people in the country who were working on the issue. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission in California had started working on the cases, and there were advocates in California that were trying to do educational work with farm worker women on the issue. And even some legal services attorneys in California had worked on the cases. But there wasn't anyone who dedicated 100% of their time to really figuring out the issue and creating the resources. And what I knew going into it was that a lot of attorneys in the legal services community recognized that this was a problem, that farm worker women were experiencing gender discrimination and sexual harassment, but because of the limited resources, they didn't have anyone who could dedicate 100% of their time. So I went into this as someone who was going to be given the opportunity to focus all my energy on it, but I did have the benefit of having other allies around the country. I think as a brand new attorney, getting people to pay attention and want to work with you, I think that's a different challenge. But I was fortunate because people were very welcoming and have been very supportive. And in fact, some of those organizations and agencies that I reached out to before I even graduated from law school, because I had actually kind of crafted the project before I graduated from law school, they wanted to help, and they saw the possibility. But I think that the idea was so grand that people didn't know if it could really work. And so now, you know, over 10 years later, when I talk to some of those allies, people, we always sort of marvel at the fact that collectively we've been able to make a lot of progress. But there's still so much work that we have to do. And so we talk about the fact that we're just barely scratching the surface, and you know, thankfully they let a 25-year-old try to take this on, and I did, and have been really pleased to see where it's gone.
And you talk about the projects. You've started some projects to mm-hmm. kind of help with this initiative, with this issue, one of which is the Bandana Project.
That's
Can you
right.
talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So the Bandana Project is a public awareness campaign focused on raising awareness about sexual violence against farmworker women. And essentially what I asked people to do in 2007 at the first national conference on this issue, I asked each of the participants to decorate a white bandana as a symbol of our dedication to ending sexual violence against farmworker women. And the reason that I did that was because farmworker women have said that they use their clothes, including bandanas, to cover themselves up, to obscure the fact that they're women, because they felt by doing that, that would lessen the chances of them becoming victims of workplace sexual violence. And so in lots of senses, the bandana and even clothes were sort of symbols of oppression, right? The fact that women had to obscure their gender in order to be safe in the workplace. And so I decided that, you know, the perpetrators have so much power at work. You know, oftentimes they speak English and the victims don't. They know the resources that could be available to help someone, like the police, and the victims don't. They're connected in the community and the victims aren't. So there are all these reasons that perpetrators have power, and there are many ways in which they are constantly exerting that power and oppressing people. And I wanted to take something tangible and say, you know, we're taking this back. And so we're viewing this bandana right now as a symbol of oppression, but you know what, we're taking it back, and this is going to be our flag. This is our battle cry that we're ending violence against farmworker women. And so that's how we appropriated the bandana. And now thousands of people all over the country and in different parts of the world have joined us in this campaign. They've decorated bandanas. They've displayed them in places like the Museum of Tolerance in Los Angeles and schools and universities all over the country. Farmworker women have started decorating bandanas in small groups as a part of therapy. It's really incredible to see how the project has taken off, but the purpose is to raise awareness about a problem that most people don't know about, and to have something like the bandana, which is very tangible, to give people the opportunity to express both their solidarity with the women who are experiencing the problem, but it also provides an outlet to the women themselves who are experiencing the problem to express what they're feeling without having to get up in a crowded room and make a declaration.
I know large issues like this are often very multi-layered, but why do you think it is that it continues to be such a problem? What are some of, I'm sure there are multiple reasons, but what are some of sort of the main reasons?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really important for the listeners to understand that when we talk about the scope of the problem, the few studies that have been done have shown that, you know, 80 to 90% of women interviewed have expressed that sexual harassment is a major workplace problem for them. And a study that I co-wrote and published in 2010 called Injustice on Our Plates, we interviewed women here in Arkansas. We interviewed people in Florida, California, Iowa, and several other states. And of those interviews, 100% of the women that we interviewed said that sexual harassment was an issue, a major issue that they're experiencing at work. And so, you know, we're not talking like 20% of the population. We're talking about staggering numbers of people who are experiencing this problem. So I think that's important for people to understand. And I think the root causes of sexual harassment in the workplace include poverty. I think the fact that women, particularly farmworker women, they don't have many options for what kind of work they'll do. It's very difficult for them to get jobs in agriculture. There's a lot of discrimination against women in terms of employing them. And so when the women are able to get jobs, the perpetrators use that knowledge of the fact that they could be blacklisted or kept out of the workforce to their advantage to oppress the women and to exploit them. And so I think that's a huge factor. When, you know, these have been hard economic times, and women feel like they have to put up with it because they don't want to get fired. They're trying to feed their families. And so that's a huge issue, I think, and the reason that the violence continues to be perpetrated. The other issue, of course, is immigration status. Not all farmworker women are undocumented, but a large percentage of farmworkers are undocumented. And, you know, the immigration debate in the last few years hasn't been friendly to immigrants. You know, if we look at the state laws that have been passed and that have been anti-immigrant, it's created this hostile environment for immigrants. And that hostility has been used by perpetrators against women by saying things to them like, you're not wanted here, no one wants to protect you. And so they've used that power to sexually violate the women. And those are just a couple of the issues. I mean, there are many reasons this is happening. I think that we're in a place and in a time where more people are starting to learn about the problem. And I think that there are more resources available to help farmworker women. But one of the challenges that we have is ensuring that the information about the resources makes it to the communities. And given the language barriers that sometimes exist, particularly now that we're seeing more indigenous speaking workers. You know, before we had a large number of Spanish speakers, and it was sometimes difficult to get the information to them because of that language barrier. But now we're talking about people who speak indigenous languages where there are no interpreters. It might not even be written, so we can't even create materials to get them information about their rights. So that's a challenge. And when you're in a situation like that where you have resources and people have rights, but you can't get the information to the people, that creates another layer and another barrier to ensure that people have access to justice.
Well, what are some of their rights? Because I think sometimes if you come to, you know, a new country and there's that language barrier, you're not quite sure what you're entitled to, and they do have rights. Is that correct?
That's right. And I think that's a very important point that you make, because I have interviewed women all around the country and have represented women in a number of different states, and oftentimes they tell me that they didn't know that they had rights. They didn't know that anyone could help them. And so when someone is a victim of sexual harassment in the workplace, that's covered by a law called Title VII. Title VII prohibits discrimination in the workplace, including sex discrimination, and sexual harassment is considered a form of sex discrimination. And so if someone is working at a company that has 15 or more employees, they're covered by that federal law. If they work in a place that has fewer than 15 employees, there might be state law protections that provide them protections. But I think that one of the other things, even if people find out that there are protections against discrimination, they sometimes think that because they're undocumented, they wouldn't be covered by the law. And documented and undocumented people are covered by Title VII. And so that's really important for us to ensure that people know that so that they can assert their rights. But the other thing I think is retaliation is a huge concern. They're afraid that if they come forward, they'll be fired, blacklisted, that they'll be reported to immigration, you know, things like that. And the other thing that's very important for us as advocates to communicate is that there are protections against retaliation in the workplace. And so if something like that were to happen, we could then also try to get them protection under the law for retaliation. But the reality is that people don't come forward for very good reasons. You know, I was actually on a panel earlier this week in Chicago, and we were talking about this a little bit, and, you know, we were sort of discussing the fact that there are people today who are working in, you know, restaurants and factories, banks, who knows, in different locations who are not happy with their jobs, right? But they can't leave, either because they have financial constraints or they have other responsibilities, or, you know, it's just not the right time in their lives to leave. And so there are lots of valid reasons that people every day don't leave their job, even when they're not experiencing something like sexual harassment. And for those same valid reasons, farmworker women and other immigrant women are not leaving their jobs. And it's not that they want to endure what they're enduring. It's not that it's okay. It's not that they don't feel pain. It's that they just can't leave. And I think that people need to understand that. And I think that as consumers, we need to show that we support women. We need to explain to them that we will stand with them if they decide to take action. And I think that we need to do our part to ensure that the companies that we're buying products from know that we are not willing to buy products from people who exploit and abuse workers. And I think that as consumers, that's a way that we can help people who are in a very difficult situation, who might not be able to leave their jobs, still get some kind of relief and some kind of semblance of protection. Because the truth is that for women who are living in a place where there are few options for them, they might not be able to walk away. But if I, as a consumer, stand up and say, hey, X company, I'm not going to continue buying products from you because you abuse the women who work for you, then maybe that external pressure is going to help the women who have to stay in a situation that's, you know, intolerable or difficult for them to sustain.
Can you tell me a little bit about how your organization helps some of these migrant workers?
Sure. So my organization is a binational organization. It's actually based in Mexico City. We have an office in southern Mexico in the state of Oaxaca, and we have an office in Baltimore, which is where I'm located. And the majority of the workers who we work with are in the United States on guest worker visas. So they have temporary visas to work in the United States for a short period of time. And one of the ways that we work with them is by educating them about their rights before they come to the United States so that they know that when they're here, if they experience some kind of workplace problem, that there are people who can help them. And often people don't report the problems until they go back home because they don't feel safe while they're in the United States to report the problems. But once they get home, they might contact us if they've had a problem, and then we either represent them because we have U.S. attorneys on staff who can help people with cases, or we refer them to other attorneys. And the other way in which we help migrant workers and immigrant workers is by doing advocacy in D.C., with federal agencies and with members of Congress to educate them about some of the issues that people are experiencing, some of the shortfalls in the law, some of the ways in which people, they might have protection under the law, but they're not actually able to receive the protection because of some barrier like immigration. You know, one of the things I've been doing a lot in the last few months is trying to raise awareness about workplace sexual violence in the workplace and how it is affected by our broken immigration system. So I've done a lot of work to try to educate people about how this broken system is really exposing women to more violence because perpetrators are using immigration status against them. And so our organization uses this multi-pronged approach to try to get justice for workers and to improve their conditions.
Monica Ramirez is Deputy Director of Centro de los Derechos del Migrante. She stopped by KUAF late last week. More information about her organization can be found at CD Migrante, that's MIGRANTE.org.